Good morning, everybody, and thank you for coming to our Paris Air Show investor briefing. It's an early start, and it's difficult sometimes with all the traffic. I hope we can promise you some better weather today than yesterday, although I have to say, looking at it just now, it doesn't seem to be running in our favour. I think many of you know me. I'm the CFO at Rolls-Royce, and I certainly see some familiar faces. It's nice to see some new ones too. Of course, you heard from me last, certainly in a group at the prelims, and you'll be hearing from me shortly at the interims on the 25th of July. But today, you'll be pleased to know, is not about me talking, and it is not a trading update. As you'd expect with the Paris Air Show, we're going to focus, provide a little bit of context and colour on our civil aerospace business and our defence aerospace business. And with me to my right, I have Tony Wood, who's our new president of aerospace, and Tony's going to talk to you a little bit about civil. Many of you will know Tony, will be familiar with him. You've seen him before. Of course, he used to run our marine business, and prior to that, our repair and overhaul business, and he's even spent some time in defence as well. So he's been with Rolls-Royce a long time. And to his right is Tom Bell, who is our president of defence, and he's going to talk to you a little bit about defence in terms of providing context and colour. So what we're going to do today is both Tony and Tom are going to talk for about 20 minutes about civil and defence. We'll then open up the floor for Q&A, and then we'll finish promptly at 9:45. And those of you that have booked a place on a bus to go to the Paris Air Show, the buses will be waiting outside. If those of you haven't, I'm afraid, I'm sorry, the buses are fully, all the seats are taken, so we don't want to create too much chaos outside. So if you booked a seat on a bus, they'll be waiting promptly for you on the outside. And with that, I will hand over to Tony. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark, and a very good morning to everybody. The good news for those of you in the room this morning is that you'll be going to the Paris Air Show a little later this morning than most of the rest of the contingent that try and work their way around the peripheric. And having done the 2.5-hour trip round town yesterday, I'm hoping we can get to there a little more efficiently today. So, as Mark said in the introduction, my name's Tony Wood. I've been with Rolls-Royce for about a dozen years. I'm an engineer by background. I guess I'm still the new boy in Rolls-Royce, having only been here for 12 years, relative to some of my colleagues. I think the average age in Rolls-Royce is still, average length of service is still something like 17 or 18 years, so I'm getting there. But I have very much, as Mark said, been around the group. So I've certainly worked in defence aerospace and worked for quite a period of time in the civil aerospace business. Mike Terrett may be familiar with some of you. I was Mike's COO a few years back. And also services, and most recently marine. So I've just about wiped the salt water out of my eyes, having been working in the offshore and the merchant industry, and now back into the civil aerospace business. And I'm very pleased to be here today. So I'm picking up the baton from Mark King, who I guess will have spoken to you over the last few years, having been in this role previously for around 5 years. And the business is in a good place. It's a great company. It's doing pretty well at the moment. Great people and strength in depth across the company in terms of the number of people we have in all of our businesses and what you would expect from a company like Rolls-Royce in terms of how we've developed strength in our various divisions. And a lot of the success of the company is down to the performance of the civil business, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that today. I guess, so why is that? You know, where is the strength in the civil business coming from? Well, clearly the growth in emerging markets has been a big part of our story. A lot of new planes on order, a lot of new planes coming to market, the more efficient versions, A350, 787 being a very big part of the story that I guess we'll all be hearing at this air show. High fuel costs and the drive for people to replace old aircraft around the world, very big part of the story and the growth story in civil particularly. And as you've seen, very big backlogs in both Airbus and Boeing product particularly, on which we have a very significant stake. So as Mark King said to me in the middle of May, it was okay when I left it. It's now up to you to pick the business up and take it forward. So 4 weeks in, this is the story today as to how I see the business and what's going on around the world. I've spent the last 4 weeks with Mark, actually, traveling pretty extensively around the world, the airframers, the customers, the people that drive our business, speaking to them, understanding what's happening, how they see our performance, what are the issues that they have with us, looking at the growth plans for the whole aerospace business, and looking at how we improve our financial performance, which obviously we're going to talk about a little bit more today. So I'm going to try and tell the story this morning by telling you how I see the business through something that some of you will doubtless be very familiar with, the four C's. It's something actually that John Rishton is pretty passionate about. It's actually the language with which we talk about and see the business internally. It's how we communicate to our employees, it's how we communicate with our customers, and it works equally well in this environment in terms of how we see things. So no slides this morning. I find air shows are all about people. It's about who you talk to, what you learn, and about obviously the products and services, which hopefully many of you will have a chance to see later today at the air show with many of the great flying displays and things that will come along this afternoon. I'm going to speak for about 20 minutes, and then I'm going to hand over to my colleague who's going to balance for 20 minutes on a very low-cost stool there. It's all part of the cost story that's coming, Tom, before we look at the rest of the business. So four C's. The first C, customer. There's one thing that you notice about the structure of a company like Rolls-Royce. We're a business-to-business company. There are actually a relatively small number of interfaces, people in the business who talk to the customer every day. Of our 44,000 people, there's only a few thousand of them, I imagine, that really know and really feel every day what the customer thinks about the company. How are we performing? Very different in a sort of business-to-consumer environment where most of your employees know because they're tripping over the customer and talking to the customer every day. That is one of the challenges of running a business like aerospace in Rolls-Royce. How do you get that customer voice, that customer impetus into the business? And for me, it's about constant reminders that the customer pays for absolutely everything that we do and enables everything that we do within the business. And it's easy to forget that when you're working away in a purchasing department, in a finance department, or elsewhere within the business. And that really is the mantra with which I approach the whole team worldwide in aerospace, is never ever forget that the customer is actually what drives and what enables everything that we do and pays for everything around this business. So we have a simple strategy. It's placing the customer at the heart of the business, understanding and shaping how our customer thinks about things, and using obviously our balance of technology and understanding of the customer to take products and services to market, and focusing on customers and focusing particularly on how we respond. Responsiveness really matters in this industry. So rather than me tell you any more about how our customers feel about us, no slides, but I'm going to show you a very short video of some of our major customers around the world, if we could.
It's interesting that a number of years ago I spoke to a Rolls-Royce team, and we talked about responsiveness then, about the speed of response to modifications and to operational disruption and the safety issues. And I'm really pleased that Rolls have not only recognised that, but you're now building that into your vision. There's two aspects to that. One is you're actually listening to the customer, and the second is you're responding to the customers.
Room for improvements I see in the line of communication between the operator and Rolls-Royce.
It's not about succeeding once, it's about succeeding every single departure.
The Rolls-Royce brand has always had a quality establishment to it, and we need that to be maintained. But it's not just in the quality of the product, it's in the quality of the service these days.
Which is about speeding up modifications, speeding up performance of the engines, looking at your turnaround time on your various workshops. Again, that's where Rolls can continue to improve, it continue to improve its performance that has a direct benefit to the customer.
Please remember that we all too have skin in the game with Rolls-Royce. Our future depends pretty much on Rolls-Royce's ability to do what is right first time, each time, and every time.
So just a snapshot from some of those out there. Those few customers represent about 10% of our current order book, excluding some of the announcements we've made over the course of the last 2 weeks. So it's a good news, bad news story in terms of things we have to do. Customers like us. The one thing that certainly I've felt over the last month as I've been around the world talking to our major customers, airframers, airlines alike, is they like dealing with Rolls-Royce. They find us easy to deal with, they find us quite accommodating, but we frustrate them. And we frustrate them largely in the areas of delivery, quality, reliability, and responsiveness in terms of our ability to just have a consistent business, a business that performs every day. In the words of William Tan there, who runs the engineering business for Singapore Airlines, really doing a great job at the top of the game every day, trusted to deliver excellence, that we deliver and that it's excellent in terms of what the expectations are. And quality, delivery, reliability, and responsiveness are how we look at the performance of the business and driving our performance for customers. Golden Threads is the name we use internally. And it's about the link between what customers want and obviously our capability as a technology provider and developer to try and innovate and meet those customer needs. But it's all around those four threads that really is what drives how customers feel about us and how the business performs. So the issues around customers today, well, getting the voice of that customer into the business, as I've said, getting a line of sight through the business, getting all of the businesses through regions, through sites, through functions actually aligned with what we're trying to do, and getting a very joined up through life approach. In terms of our commercial offering, it is very joined up, as you well know, between our original equipment offering and our service packages that support them through life. How well are we doing organizationally to make sure that we're actually organizing ourselves to manage the various elements of those? And doing it from new product introduction through to production cycle through to aftermarket and services. Almost all of our customers are having conversations with us about new product offerings, about deliveries of new aircraft coming off the line today, and about how we're servicing their installed base. This is a long cycle, long-term game. These relationships are 30, 40, 50-year relationships with many of these airlines, and it's about being able to join up those conversations that are very much work done in different parts of the organization. And we're trying to manage that across around 300 civil customers and about 160 defense forces, I guess, Tom, around the world today. So what actions are we taking? Well, you've seen an announcement about an aero organization. 1st of January this year, we combined our defense business, our civil business, and our supply chain as one aerospace organization across the entire group. And that's the role that I'm facing off to in terms of the conversation we're having today. And we did that for a very deliberate reason. It's about aligning the organization to the heartbeat of the customer. One of the challenges of having a supply chain organization that is separate is how do you manage the gearbox between your businesses and your supply chain to make sure that performance is always aligned, not just in front of the customer, but also in terms of leveraging the financial performance of the business. And one set of metrics, you know, having the supply chain team having a set of metrics on how they believe they're performing and then the business teams having a different set of metrics clearly doesn't work. So actually joining all of that up in the organization is what we've driven for. And it's had quite a profound impact on the workforce. I was walking through one of our businesses up in the UK the other day and just asking questions about, you know, what does the aerospace organization mean for you? Does it mean anything for you in terms of what's changed? And what it's done is it's reconnected a very large supply chain organization in our business back with customers and back with products. When you're working in a turbine blade facility making thousands and thousands of turbine blades a year, you can sometimes lose that line of sight of that turbine going into an engine for a particular customer like one of those you've seen on the video there. We've put the purpose back in and the alignment back into our supply chain and given us also the opportunity to start to leverage the business benefits of running that combined unit better. And we've had some early wins. Some of our major programs, our largest production program on wide bodies today is the Trent 700. About 50% of the A330s in the world today are powered by Rolls-Royce. About 75% of the aircraft being built in Toulouse today are being powered by Trent 700s. delivery performance to due day has been 100% on time for more than 2 years now. That was around 62% if you roll the clock back 3 years ago. And obviously the customer implications and the inventory implications of that were very significant. We're running a tighter ship these days, and absolutely my message to the team and my intent is that we continue to both lean out and sustain that performance. Trent 1000 going into the 787. Less mature, earlier stage of its production program, ramping up quickly now, 100% on time to due day, and it's been there for the last 9 months. One of the most challenging programs in terms of trying to work with the customer on maturing that aircraft, but the drumbeat of the business, managing flow, managing inventory, getting that customer focus in. Snags, and by snags on engines, I'm talking about paint blemishes, about temperature coloration issues on pipes, on casings. We've halved the number of snags per engine going into the Airbus and the Boeing build lines by, halved it over the last 12 months. Very aggressive program, putting the customer's eyes into the business. It's not about fundamental quality flaws, it's about how it looks and feels and what the customer expects, getting the paperwork word perfect. And probably the most impressive stat on how the customer feels about us, the industry in aerospace drives about a 10% year-on-year improvement in disruption. The disruption that a technical issue causes, that delays an aircraft dispatch, causes an aborted takeoff, a cancellation in some cases. So the industry has been improving at about 10%. We set a goal across all Rolls-Royce products to improve it on the wide bodies by 50% over a three-year period. We're 1 year into that drive and we're bang on target in terms of the disruption as measured by the airlines around the world on the performance of Trents. This is hard to do. It's detailed work looking at the whole scope of everything we're having to manage across our engine products. So the second C, cost. Back to your stool again, Tom, I guess, in terms of how's it feeling? One thing that we talk about a lot internally is that companies sow the seeds of their demise in the good times. It's something I think about quite a lot in terms of taking on this role in aerospace. Record order books across the company, share price pretty much at an all-time high, bonuses for employees paying out close to maximums. Where's the burning platform when you talk to 44,000 people about the need to reduce cost in this business? Well, it's quite simple, and the message that we're using and is starting to resonate across the whole business is that our competitors are more profitable. It's a fact. You can read their books in terms of what they put out in the market on an annual basis. And the biggest concern I have for our competitors being more profitable in this space is that they can out-invest us on R&D, they can out-invest us on CapEx and capability, they can strategically price in particular campaigns in terms of how they're positioning against us. And M&A clearly is an area in which they're pushing through and pushing ahead. The message is getting through. It's the key message across the company. And there is significant opportunity to improve margins across the Rolls-Royce aerospace business. On my watch, coming in about £7.5 billion of cost base in aerospace alone to tackle. 60% of that's purchased, 30% of it is people walking on two legs, 10% of it is IT and all of the overhead support that we have to drive our businesses. So just over a month ago, we picked six of our best and brightest senior managers across the business and put them together as the team to go attack cost. So whilst the drive every day works in the business, we took a look across the entire aerospace organization at where are the opportunities on cost. Every area of cost, total cost, nothing off limits. No stone unturned in terms of some of the conversations we've had, and certainly Mark and I had a chance to look through some of the recommendations that came out of that. It was quite an enlightening experience to put a different lens, a different perspective on how costs are being driven across the business. And it's not just the doing 100 things 1% better lots of those ideas coming up from the teams. It's the structural and transformational issues as well as the incremental day-to-day improvements. And we've formed a team in place now across all businesses, and we call it very simply ACT, Address Cost Today. That's the mantra across the aerospace business. We've changed the focus, we've changed the ambition on cost reduction. We're looking at greater competition in our supply chain. Clearly many opportunities to do that, and we're looking at the alignment of incentives across people in every area of the business. And we're making some progress, literally a few weeks into a different lens, building on the work that we've been doing for the last few years. But volume helps. This business is growing. 2,200 Trents in service today. That number will double in service over the course of the next 5 years. And volume helps in both the original equipment side of the business, the leverage that gives us in our own facilities on volume and overhead recoveries. It also gives it in the supply chain, clearly, in terms of our purchasing leverage. And one of the reasons we're not having a big supplier forum at this air show is because we had that conversation with all of our suppliers worldwide about expectations on cost just a few weeks ago. So lots of leverage on the OE. In the aftermarket side, the leverage is equally just as great. We overhaul worldwide something like 3 large engines a day. An average overhaul cost for an aerospace engine is somewhere between £2 and £4 million overhaul cost. Turning up the dial progressively on looking at the amount of material fit, looking at the repair opportunities, looking at the opportunity to increase the lives on those components, just a few percentage points with that sort of volume on an annual overhaul rate of something around 1,000 engines is a significant dial that we can start to dial into, and we are. But almost more powerful still is using what Rolls-Royce knows best, which is as the fleet grows, we get an extraordinary amount of visibility using the engine health monitoring data, using the fleet data, and understanding how the product's performing to start to look at extending the life of that product on wing. And on the Trent 700, which is, as I said, our biggest in-service program today, we've extended the time on wing by about 4,500 hours. And to a big airline operator, that's an extra year that that engine will stay on wing without coming in for that £2 to £4 million cost-driven overhaul. That's where the engineering and the technology in our business actually makes a big difference. And that, coupled with volume, as I've said, is a big opportunity for us. And progressively, we are going to start to work that much harder. But it's not just the clever stuff, it's equally the small stuff. And we've looked very hard at how we organise our travel arrangements across the business. We'll be saving something like £20 million this year alone by tightening up on the way that travel's organised across the business. So a big focus on cost. And now to cash, the third C. Improving margins, clearly by addressing cost, delivers more cash into the business. But we've got to deal with the headwinds of the growth of new programmes. And by far the biggest opportunity in our business on cash is inventory. We're carrying today around £3 billion of inventory at the group level, biased clearly largely by a lot of the products in the aerospace business. Our competitors are running at about double, in some cases, the inventory turns that we're running. We're running at about 3 turns currently, just over. So there's around about a £1.5 billion opportunity in our balance sheet today over time to start to address inventory. And a half a turn improvement throws off around about £400 million. So yes, we have a broad portfolio. When you talk to the teams in the business, lots of reasons why our inventory is what it is. Interesting, but not very interesting in terms of the opportunity to start to address and deal with some of that, and that is the focus. So we are gradually turning the dials up on our management of inventory. The aero organization helps in terms of looking at the alignment and the plan that drives inventory across the business. We've got much better visibility across the value stream, and particularly we're taking a lot of action on looking at buffers. We are absolutely not going to compromise any of the customers you saw on the video there by taking rash decisions on inventory. But across our business, the way we were organized previously, we were optimizing and making buffer decisions around different elements in the value chain rather than looking at it from demand signal right the way through to the supply chain. That is throwing off lots of opportunities to look at a better leaning out of that supply chain, which will deliver cash. We're also looking at strategic material buys. There's a lot of exotic materials that we use in gas turbines where we have to protect surety of supply, but equally make sure that inventory is being managed. Around about £80 million of strategic inventory, actually, that we store today, materials like rhenium and some of the other complex alloying elements that we use in turbine blades. Opportunity there too. Actually being able to see and utilize serviceable used material that comes out of our overhaul shops. Joining up all of our overhaul network, something I was responsible for just 18 months ago. We now have the systems to be able to more accurately manage the inventory that comes out of an engine on overhaul and look at reusing it. We've put about £30 million worth of that product back into engines being overhauled. Immediate cash benefit coming out of doing that over the course of the last 12 months or so. So lots to go at, not easy, but a huge prize on cash as we start to work through it that we have to deliver. And it's balancing the headwinds of growth with the opportunities that we have to improve whilst protecting the customer. And finally, the fourth C, concentration. It's really easy to get distracted in this business. Like all of us, the amount of email traffic and opportunity that comes across our desk on things that we could do is almost insatiable. There's always an idea, there's always something else that we could do in this business, but staying focused and being clearer about what we are going to invest in and the criteria for that versus what we're not going to invest in is something that I've been spending quite a lot of time on even over the last 4 weeks with the team. The actions we're taking, well, clearly the four C's is helping. It's simplifying the business. It's getting people more focused around what's important, helping them to concentrate. Customers, cost, cash, very simple messages that people can understand. But we've got, obviously, the headwinds to offset. So we're having a very careful look at our market opportunities, and we chose not to play on the A320neo program. We looked at it very carefully. It was a very deliberate decision. We couldn't make sense of a business case on that, given where we were, to invest and go forwards on that program. But we were very focused on the A350 XWB. There's about three times the thrust coming out of a Trent XWB engine, and we were only a 33% shareholder in IAE in 25% of the narrow-body market. So the math says the opportunity on a Trent XWB was nearly 10 times the scale in revenue terms and service opportunity terms to our participation on, you know, other things that we could have done. So we were very focused around that particular program. And the long-term core programs of the 787 and the 350, which I started with, are really the big stories of the wide-body market for tomorrow, and we have significant stakes in both of those programs, clearly. On R&D, there's no let-up in our need to stay at the leading edge of the technology race on gas turbines. This business is about fractions of a percent of fuel burn and being able to deliver for customers. You know, many of you know how airlines make decisions. Staying at that leading edge, whether it's fan technology, combustion technology, turbine technology, how we optimize the system, that is our business. We will continue to invest in R&D. And even whilst program cycles and program opportunities wane, we're going to remain very focused on that. It's not just about the technology, it's also about the cost. We've applied already some 300 engineers to cost. We've been ramping that up over the last few years. We're going to ramp that up further again this year in terms of around about another 100 people in our cost-focused team alone. Big part of our R&D story. And we've got a lot more to do, I sense, on deciding what we do in the business versus what we buy and where our outsource opportunities are. And we're becoming much more discerning about that as we start to concentrate more on what we're good at. So several wins. We obviously did the IAE deal, The aero engine controls business was acquired from Goodrich recently. More engineers being invested in cost and more concentration around that, very strong returns from that engineering team. And in R&D investment in fuel burn improvements and weight improvements, that will be the battleground that continues in terms of our focus. So in conclusion, the four C's, customer, cost, cash, and concentration is how I see it. It's how we talk about the business internally. It's not going to go away anytime soon, and we're building momentum behind each of those four themes across the business. The management incentives are aligned around doing those things well. There are lots of opportunities, but there's also some pretty big headwinds out there that we're going to have to deal with as we go forwards as well. So I hope you've got a slightly better understanding about how I see the four C's and what we're doing in that area. But it's an air show this week, and this is what we do. It's about people, it's about products, and what we do for our shareholders and our stakeholders is very much captured in a short video I want to show you of something that I had the pleasure of seeing on Friday last week. Engineer in the aerospace business, that's what makes the hair stand up on the back of your neck. The first time that a new aircraft of an entirely new design with many new technologies on flies is a very special moment. It's actually the first one that I've seen in my entire career, despite having been through many, many programs over the last 27 years or so. I've usually been back in the office doing something else, but on this occasion, it was too big to miss. A very special event. So some last thoughts. I'm going to go back to the retail business, because it's one that I stumbled across the other day and just really struck me in terms of that message I started with on the customer. And it's something Sam Walton of Walmart fame once said. There is only one boss, the customer. And he can fire everybody from the chairman right on down through the business simply by spending his money somewhere else. That's what the Paris Air Show is about for us in terms of that focus on customers and never forgetting just how important they are for our business. And that is what placing the customer at the heart of the business is all about and why it's so important to the rest of the story as we work through cost, cash, and concentrate on the opportunities that are out there. So that's the story for a chunk of the aerospace business. I'm now going to hand over to my friend Tom, who's been very patiently balancing on the stool there, and see if I can balance on it too.
I'm happy to stand up.
Over to you, Tom.
Thank you, Tony.
Cheers.
Thank you very much. And anybody who's feeling like they've got to stretch their legs for a minute, don't worry, you can stand up if you'd like and stretch your legs while I talk. Good morning, and thank you for joining us also. My name is Tom Bell, and I think I get the merit badge for shortest Rolls-Royce employee standing in front of you today, because next week I'll celebrate my one-year anniversary with Rolls-Royce. So given that I'm a little bit new to all of you, I thought I would take a little bit of time and introduce myself to you. I'm 30 years in this industry, starting in a place that's not usually synonymous with aerospace excellence, New Orleans, Louisiana. New Orleans, Louisiana is where I joined Martin Marietta back in the day at the Michoud Assembly Facility working on a NASA program. I joined the Manufacturing Engineering Planning and Control Department after a couple summer internships and was thrilled to join them full-time upon graduation from university. Spent 5 years with Martin Marietta and then took my family up north to St. Louis, Missouri, where I joined then McDonnell Douglas. That one career move took a series of progressions over 25 years with McDonnell Douglas Boeing, with two overseas assignments, a little placement in Seattle, many times in St. Louis, and finally ending up in Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. is where I've lived for about 7 years in this business and where I have the pleasure of leading Rolls-Royce Defense into the future. When I'm not working, which is increasingly rare, I do like to get out. I like hiking, kayaking, and trying to do that thing called breathing. You know, in Washington, D.C., you've got to get out of Washington, D.C. in order to breathe. And so I enjoy getting out about an hour west into the mountains and the Shenandoah River and trying to get some peace and quiet and breathe. Now, before I launch into the seas, since I run the defense business for Rolls-Royce, I'm sure everybody here wants to talk about this word we never could pronounce 3 years ago called sequestration. I remember when it first was published, I said, now how do you pronounce that? And now I'm amazed at how easily it rolls off my tongue. But sequestration is a fact of life, and it's a fact of life for us in defense that our customers are only now really starting to deal with. The fact is that for a couple budget cycles now, the Pentagon has essentially played a game of chicken, if you will, when it comes to the Congress and trying to plan how they do this thing called sequestration. But Secretary Hagel and the Pentagon are now, with fiscal 14 and fiscal 15, very much leaning into and planning for sequestration. Unfortunately for us, we don't yet know exactly how that's going to manifest itself. So we are not in a position to look at our long-term forecast and say, this is up, this is down, this is the net effect. The good news is, with 25 products, 103 countries, and 160 customers, the fact is we feel as if the breadth and depth of our portfolio gives us an opportunity to weather this storm better than our competitors. And in fact, the four C's that I'd like to talk to you about in defense play very much into our strategy for exploiting this opportunity called sequestration. A little bit odd, you might think, but let me explain as I go through the four C's. As an overview in defense, before I get into the individual four C's, I'd like to talk to you about an engine. Now, I've purposely not labeled this engine because it's a test. No, it's not a test. This is the F-136. The F-136 is an engine you may have heard about in past Rolls-Royce defense briefings or, in fact, GE investor briefings. It's an engine we and GE developed to be an alternate engine for the F-35. It was a fantastic engine. I'll say, and you can tell Pratt & Whitney I said, it was better than 135. It was better than their engine. But it got the four C's wrong. It got the four C's wrong. It didn't understand that in the current customer environment, the customer was not going to pay twice to develop engines for one application. We had latent customer understanding of how absolutely definitive they were in that statement. And so the F-136 was canceled. And I don't have a revenue stream today as a result of the investment in this product. And that's unacceptable. That's unacceptable for any business leader to invest money, take time, devote resources to a product where we don't then turn that into a revenue stream for shareholders and for employees. And so we got the customer wrong. We didn't challenge the design teams and the business teams on cost enough to really present a value proposition that resonated with the customer. And as a result, another C, we were concentrating on something that didn't derive a revenue stream for Rolls-Royce Defense. So a little summary in one engine of not getting the four C's right. And so with that, I'd like to dive into the four C's individually and talk a little bit about where maybe we're getting it right these days. So first C, customer. When I talk to the defense team, I like to try to underscore this C with this simple phrase. We need to have unparalleled customer understanding. Unparalleled customer understanding. Whether it be Walmart, whether it be Neiman Marcus, whether it be AT&T or Vodafone, whoever you are, whatever business you're in, if you have unparalleled customer understanding, you can differentiate yourself in the marketplace. Because if you have unparalleled customer understanding, you have insights into customers' true wants, fears, hopes, dreams, desires, inhibitions, inabilities. And when you can tap into that unparalleled customer understanding, you then can bring solutions to the marketplace that for the customer resonate. And when you can do that, the customer buys your product. So if you can have unparalleled customer understanding, I contend you can differentiate yourself in any marketplace. And certainly that's true today in the defense marketplace. So let's talk about an example where I think we're getting this right. The 3.5 kit for the C-130. The C-130 heritage aircraft, there are about 1,000 of these, more than 1,000 in the global inventory. And the fact is, the customers who fly this product love it. They love it. But they want, and here's the real important part, they'll pay for improved SFC, specific fuel consumption, improved time on wing, and improved power. And so our engineers, faced with that challenge of how to take this legacy product and improve it for today's customer environment, created what we call the 3.5 kit, which after testing by the US Air Force in rigorous conditions, has proved that 10% fuel consumption improvement, 20% reliability improvement, and increased power across the spectrum for this kit. In fact, the Air Force said, when we deploy this in our full fleet, we'll save the US taxpayer $2 billion over the life of these products. They said, you hit the bullseye with this product. And that's an example of our concentrating and listening to the customer and devoting our innovative capabilities in ways that delight the customer and then will turn into revenue streams for Rolls-Royce. Another example of where we've got this right is the V-22 Osprey. For some time, this product has been put into the most harsh environments known to man, and the Marine Corps and the US Special Forces have been deploying this in areas that actually were hardly envisioned when the product was designed. As a result, time on wing and cost per flight hour have not been what the Marine Corps and the US Special Forces want this product to be. So again, our engineers deployed a kit, worked with the software, worked with the engine to increase its capabilities and increase its thrust to weight ratio. And as a result, we've now got the time on wing on a great glide scope up and cost per flight hour on a dramatic reduction. A great example where we're delighting the customer by listening and innovating in the space that they are most envious for. Unparalleled customer understanding for us is going to be a competitive discriminator for us in this environment. The second C, cost, is another example where we in defense try to take this and make it very personal for our people. You know, it used to be in defense, all of you love to come to air shows and see the latest fighter jet, you know, whizzing around the sky and doing tail slides and flat pancake spins. But the fact is, customers these days are more concerned with cost than capability in many markets. There are still select markets where they'll go for the exquisite technology, but in more cases than not, low cost trumps best value. So I talk a lot to the defense team about we're in an environment where low cost beats best value. And we, Rolls-Royce, need to bring the Rolls-Royce value proposition to that lower cost environment. So again, how are we trying to tangibilize that for the defense team? One, as Tony alluded to, we're addressing travel costs, overhead costs, facility costs very aggressively. And I'm going to talk about facility costs when we talk about cash or concentration in a minute. But we're also deploying a specific should-cost mentality in each program where we've taken the four most important programs for Rolls-Royce Defense, and we've said, this is what we need to drive the cost of building this product to in order to delight the customer and succeed in the marketplace. And success for me in this case is selling the most engines. Because I contend, and I believe the marketplace is starting to prove, that if you can get your price point for technology down to a place where customers can afford more of it, in this budget environment, that product won't get cut, and customers will evolve platforms and solutions around those derivative engines. So we're very focused on cost and challenging our team to specific target unit cost targets. And through this year alone, we're well on our way in those four engines to identifying over 500,000 pounds worth of specific cost reduction activities, which will manifest themselves in the cost of our platform. An exciting opportunity for us to innovate within the customer understanding that we're endeavoring to have and leverage the environment we're in. Low cost trumps best value for Rolls-Royce Defense is not a frightening phrase, it's a liberating phrase. The third C, cash, for us in defense, happily, is again something that's not new. We've been focused on cash for a long time, and we have the benefit of a business model that is a lucrative cash business model. But being good in this environment isn't good enough. And so we've been very focused as a team on two things for cash. One, again, as Tony alluded to, is inventory turns. We're aggressively addressing inventory turns, and while differentiated between mission care and targets on mission care inventory turns, where we hold risk and therefore we can probably quantify the need for how much inventory we hold, versus the OE business where we want to drive down to a lower level of inventory turns. We are well on our way in 2013 to identifying and exploiting 100 million pounds worth of inventory reduction in our business alone. This is very exciting and won't be a one-stop journey, but rather a recurring theme as we continue to up the gain on becoming more efficient inventory holders for the corporation. But the second area we in defense are focused on when it comes to cash is a little bit of a convoluted logic, and that's called exploiting the data we have about customer pain points. We have this database, it's a little bit of big data, where we call it resolve customer issues. We have customer touch points out there with the customer all over the world, and they flow into customer service centers and tell us what's going on in our fleets, what's going on in the customer community. And by leveraging some of the tools and techniques we deployed for mission care, we're having the system and the team flag for us emerging customer pain points before they become crises. What's that got to do with cash? Well, very simply, by the time a customer pain point becomes a crisis, I as a leader have limited degrees of freedom for how I can fix that problem. And unfortunately, most times that involves throwing a lot of people, and people are cash, at the problem. And so this Resolve Customer Issues database and being exploited within defense is starting to emerge as a way we're heading off these customer crises before they impact customer satisfaction at the highest level, but also impact my bottom line from a cash and profitability standpoint. That's the third C. Fourth C, concentration, again, for us in defense is a journey we've been on for some time. And very much bringing home for the defense team with another catchphrase I like to use, which is that old thing I learned back in Martin Marietta, which is not all business is good business. It's a good mantra for these days. Not all business is good business. And it's important that as leaders, we not chase every idea that could be good business, but we be very diligent about making sure we're in the businesses that have the hurdle rates and the returns that we Rolls-Royce need and you as shareholders expect. So, with not all business as good business as our concentration mantra, we've done several things. One, we deployed a fundamental make-buy process within defense, wherein we looked at everything we were making, much of it, just an accident of history. We were making these parts because we always made these parts, and the facilities were built to make these parts. But we said, are we really world class at making that at the price point we need in this environment? And we identified 500 parts in our supply chain that we decided we were not world class at, and we could get better value for money by deploying out into the supply chain. That reduced our facilities by 33%, and we were able to offload about 500 machine tools commensurate with those products. And as a result, we're not only saving overhead costs and facility costs, but as a side benefit, we were able to move people from factories and facilities that looked like this. Anybody want to work there? You know, anybody want to go to work there? I doubt it. To this. Much more collaborative, bright, modern working place for our people. So this make-buy decision not only had a direct bottom line effect, but it also affected the morale of our people and the pride with which they come to work for Rolls-Royce. A couple other examples in defense that we're very proud of is the recently announced sale of our share of the RTM 322. Just a business that we decided Turbomeca was interested in investing in and wasn't in our core. And also our decision to stop evolving a portable power generation system for the military that we decided was not core to our business either. Concentration, doing the things that we can do well and not doing the things that others can do better, is key for our future. So, with that as a quick lap around the block of the four C's, I wanted to summarize with this statement. One, these four C's for us in defense are not a trite little poster on a wall. We're internalizing each one of them and making everybody in defense think about how they affect their day-to-day life. And two, I contend, and I firmly believe, and the defense leadership team believes, if we get these four C's right, unparalleled customer understanding, cash, cost, and concentration, we can truly differentiate us in this marketplace and exploit the opportunities for propulsion systems that the world is coming to in this environment. And if we get that right, we're going to be able to show you videos like this for generations to come with many, many products powered by Rolls-Royce power plants. Please.
One quick video. Too early. Some context and color from Tony and Tom about our civil and defense industries and obviously what we're focused on at the moment. We've talked about the four C's. And of course, as I've spoken to many of you in the past about, you know, we've got the sort of top line growth projection you can see in our order book, but of course how we start to drive the bottom line margin progression. And hopefully that gave you some idea of the sort of where we're focused on at the moment. So we're going to move to Q&A now. If you could stick your hands up, and when asked, can you just say your name and company? I'm guessing we've got some roving mics. So when someone comes to you, we'll start. And I will generally address the questions to Tony and Tom, unless there's a group question which I can help you with. But so we start with Nick. Sorry.
Does that apply to outside the aerospace business in Rolls-Royce?
Yeah, maybe I'll pick that one up, Nick. I mean, six isn't an absolute target, and my sense is, based on where we're at the moment, you know, we're probably never going to quite get there, you know, in terms of where you get to. This is an incremental game in terms of tightening up and dialing up the focus on inventory. It's not about a sudden step change. You know, we've had programs in the business in the past where we've been able to make some, you know, turn some of the dials pretty quickly, but to the detriment of our in-service performance or the detriment of our OE delivery base. So it's doing it intelligently. It's not linear. You know, clearly there are some quick wins, and then it gets more difficult as you start to get up the sort of leaning out the process. Some of the things I said on buffering are things that actually a very small number of people can go away and look at the overall supply chain, look at the data on the variability of supply, how it's aligned right the way through against customer demand, and we can do things relatively quickly. It gets more difficult as you get up the curve. So no specific points on the journey. It's exactly the same process, I think, from a group perspective that I've been applying in the marine business for the last 18 months, where we've made some good progress, and similarly in the energy business. This isn't something that's unique to aerospace. That £3 billion is a group number.
To add to that, Tony, in defense, what we've done is we've taken our 24, 25 products. We've got a specific inventory turn target based basically on the maturity of the engine. You know, where it is in its life cycle tells us where our inventory turn target should be. So we've taken that level of granularity and driven toward specific inventory turns per target with an aggregate average in defense also.
I think Tom made the point well in the presentation. You know, the focus here is on the original equipment drumbeat, the inventory that's coming through the factories. The size, the scale, and the revenue line that's connected to our total care packages, MRMS packages in defense, there is opportunity there for refinement. It's not the initial focus, frankly. That is an area where, you know, supporting the fleet and having service levels absolutely at the top end makes a huge difference. It's why customers buy our product. This is more about the original equipment side of the supply chain.
Mr. Wood.
Yeah.
David Lloyd from Carlson Capital. Question for you is, it seems that Rolls has made a business decision, and in fact a strategic decision, to insource or partner with everyone who does maintenance. And that is a very different model from, say, CFM, which has multiple engine shops around the world and is not so proprietary about who services their engines. You are. And one thing I have come to understand about Rolls is that you're very interested in time on wing, because time on wing equals utilization of parts. Why have you done that, when you might have been able to get a greater market share if your servicing were more ubiquitous and more broadly distributed around the world?
Well, firstly, it's not uniformly true across all of our businesses. So, you know, we do have a mixture of joint ventures in which we participate, of businesses that I would call authorized shops who are authorized to support Rolls-Royce product, and equally in the defense business, a lot of the defense business is supported by authorized shops authorized to support Rolls-Royce product.
Well, indeed so, but either they're joint ventures or they're authorized. In other words, you control them, not some engine shop that starts up somewhere.
Well, there are third parties that also, so I mean, I can name several companies around the world that also support Rolls-Royce product. But at the end of the day, you know, if you're going to be able to support a product, you need to have access to the original equipment manufacturer's knowledge in terms of, you know, how to support the detailed technical requirements on that product. You know, we take a very detailed and close-focused view on making sure that our products and our reputation around the world is managed by having a deep insight in terms of the shops that we work with to be able to support that product. That is what we're selling. You know, it's a Rolls-Royce name on the side of every one of those products, and we have to control that relationship carefully. You know, the issues that relate to the four C's on that point are very much, you know, making sure we've got the competitiveness structure right so that we can drive cost, because ultimately we do have very long-term visibility on the on the revenue line associated with our long-term contracts. That gives us great stability. It's about making sure we're designing a maintenance network around the world of, which has sufficient capacity and capability to manage the cost line. And that's really where our focus is once we've satisfied ourselves that the reputational and the reliability issues are being protected.
To be honest with you, I'm still not satisfied with that because, and I'll say why, because authorizing or joint venturing or whatever means in your control. And even if there are third parties who provide service, they must use OEM parts. And I realize that, you know, Gold Care is, it's a great thing. That makes perfect sense to me. But for example, if there were an airline that wanted to use PMA parts, you know, just because they wanted to do it, United does that, you don't have them necessarily as a customer if only you control who they get their parts from, or their JV partner, or your affiliate.
Yeah, two answers, I think, so in terms of your challenge. I mean, the first one is, from a PMA perspective, frankly, you know, good luck to people in terms of how that is. The unparalleled understanding that goes into the design and development of those products is the assurance we give to the market on the performance of those products in service. You know, if I'm sat on an aircraft, I want to know that the OEM has had a big input into the reliability and the design, and that we've not compromised any of the decisions that are taken in the maintenance process. I mean, the example I gave about time on wing, when you're talking about the length of time that a turbine blade will perform satisfactorily, you know, that's kind of hard to do if you haven't got the sort of depth of engineering understanding, the sort of tests that we do both on computers or equally by validation tests on test rigs to be able to assure that that product's going to perform in service. And we've seen the occasions when that goes wrong, and frankly, that's not something that we're prepared to step into. So, you know, there is a difference here. On the PMA side, or on the broader side of the engines, you know, we've invested literally hundreds of millions of pounds, billions of pounds in the development of these products. That is the value that we're putting out there in the market. That's the value we're going to protect through that authorization process as well. Several hands. So.
We'll get you next.
George Ferguson from Bloomberg Industries. I have a question for you, Tom, on C-130. So would you be willing to give us a price point around what this modification might cost per engine on C-130? And the second part of the question would be, when you look at C-130 opportunities in the future, are they reworking the existing fleet, or is there... How do you feel about new build
C-130? Yeah, with all due respect, I'd prefer not to give you a specific price, but I'll tell you this. The payback based on an average fleet usage of a heritage C-130 is about 4 years. It depends how many flying hours, you know, the Air Force uses the C-130 for, but, you know, a good rule of thumb is a customer can expect a full payback in 4 years. And as you can appreciate, these assets live in inventories in air forces around the world for decades, literally decades. And so we feel very good about the value proposition there. To the second part of your question, we're in, beg I say, the catbird seat here, because it's the legacy Rolls-Royce engine that I'm offering the upgrade kit on for the heritage C-130s, and we're also the exclusive manufacturer of engines for the C-130J. So when a customer or when Lockheed Martin is talking to customers that may be a heritage C-130 operator, we're very much with Lockheed, and they're very much aware of our marketing activities. And It's really a choice for a customer. Do they want to upgrade their entire fleet and maybe get the new avionics and the new capabilities that are inherent in the C-130J with the 2100 Rolls-Royce engine? Or do they prefer to keep what they have, upgrade the engine, get the SFC and reliability improvements that the 3.5 kit gives them, and keep milking that asset in their inventory? So it's a little bit of we're good either way.
Yeah, it's something we've spent a lot of time about. You know, these programs don't just happen. 6.5 years ago, we started the development program on the Trent XWB for the A350. And right from the get-go, as the engineers start to work through the engine concepts and configurations, we're starting the process of designing the supply chain that's going to be able to deliver at the rates that we're projecting on these programs. Now, you know, history's shown, I think, to your point, that rate growth, you know, has always sort of slipped to the right a little bit. We've had some big examples of that recently on some of the major platforms. But nonetheless, I think the point's valid that program rates are going up, and certainly our success in the wide-body market is going to drive a big part of that. We've been on a pretty heavy investment line in terms of putting capacity into our facilities, building dual sources. You know, we've opened up for the first time in our history a full large engine assembly and test facility out in Salita. That's relieving load out of our facility in the UK and creating the capacity for the future. We've now got effectively two derbies around the world, one in Asia, one in the UK, that have got the capacity to build these engines and test them. And we've been doing that right the way down through our supply chain, through our own facilities, and working very intrusively with our suppliers to make sure that they've got the capacity plans in place to do it. And that's a multiple year process as we start to build up. And you know, our concern is your concern in terms of making sure that every point of failure within that supply chain has been covered through our supply chain design and maturity process. We treat the maturing of the supply chain no different to the maturing of the products technically in terms of making sure we can do rate. So it's been very big on our mind. In terms of the competition with the energy and industrial sectors, I'd say in the gas turbine market, that's actually a relatively small factor. We don't have a great deal of conflict with some of the energy products in our supply chains. I mean, certainly when you get back to raw material castings and things like that, at that level, we've worked quite closely with some of the big players in the world that you'll be very familiar with to make sure that there's capacity at that level. Through manufacturing and such like, we've been, you know, there's not a lot of a lot of conflict. It's that alignment. It's that detailed planning of making sure the demand signal's clear, and actually, just the time we've taken ahead of time to put those plans in place. That's what drives the difference here. And you know, making sure that the assumptions, the second guessing that goes on right the way down the supply chain, making sure we're all working to the same set of assumptions on where these programs end up.
From Oddo Securities. So my question is related to cost and cost saving, more particularly. Which area would you focus on for both civil and defense? And do you think that cost saving at 1 percentage point yearly, is it achievable going forward, or we can ever do better?
Thank you. Well, I mean, Tom and I could probably answer that together. I mean, certainly from the civil aviation business, we can always do better. And some of the pitch that I was making earlier is the fact that there's always the benefit that you have, certainly for the first few weeks and months when you start to look at a business afresh, to sort of reset expectations on the scale of the opportunity and the ambition. I'm certainly confident there's a lot of rich pickings, a lot of opportunity there. I mean, we've set very clear questions out of our supply chain in terms of our expectations through the Address Cost Today program. we're working through with every one of those suppliers as to what their delivery commitments against that are going to be. But we're certainly looking at more than a fraction of a percentage point in terms of reducing cost. Obviously, we're balancing that off against the headwinds we'll have to deal with as well in terms of the other inflationary pressures that come onto the business. I don't think we've given any specific numbers. It's balancing those two variables. But defense, Tom?
Yeah, and in defense, lest there be any doubt, our resetting our cost base is not an option. It's not a nice to have. It's not an interesting side show. The defense team is focused on this like a laser beam, because resetting our cost base is going to be necessary for us to exploit this environment. The customers are looking for these cost-effective solutions, and we've got a great range of products that at a different cost point are going to be able to exploit global demand for derivative products and new applications. And so for us in defense, it's an imperative. It's an absolute that we're driving to.
It's a follow the sleep from Credit Suisse. Just a question for Tony. Could you give us an update on the Trank 1000, the updates you're making there, obviously the new 10 variants,
yep.
And the intentional gains you think you can make in a market share on the 787?
Yeah, well, obviously we're waiting with expectation in terms of how ultimately the airframer are positioning the overall Dash 10 product. We are very focused on the whole 787 program. It is without doubt our ambition to maintain at least 50% market share on that platform. All of our investment focus has been around making sure that the Trent 1000 engine and the variants and the improvements that we've been putting into that make sure that that is the engine of choice for that platform to achieve that goal. The good news is that with some of the recent wins, the market share we're currently holding is around 47% post the recent announcements. The Dash 10 product is going to be a great aircraft. I think, whilst the overall program has struggled with some early maturity issues, extremely well reported in the press around the world, that's a program that's going to be around for the next 20, 30 years. It's a great product. It's a product we believe in. It's in a marketplace that actually has got capacity for a significant number of aircraft. So we're completely aligned, I think, with Boeing in our expectations for the aircraft. We believe that the Dash 10 product would be a great product in the marketplace. Boeing are obviously working through their sort of launch criteria in terms of initial customers and exactly when they're ready to go there. We're certainly ready with Singapore Airlines with their selection of 30 of the Dash 10 variants, subject to Boeing launching the program. We've got a development program coming through for the Dash TEN, the 10, 8, and 9 is the way the project guys remember that. But the Dash TEN program, we're driving about a 3% fuel burn improvement over the current standard of Trent 1000, obviously coming through around about 2016, 2017. So, we're very focused on that. The development program is going extremely well, and it's great to see those aircraft back up in the air again and the production line in Boeing starting to roll. Yeah, I mean, firstly on the structural costs. I mean, yes, we have a wider portfolio than both of our competitors. That's a fact of history. It gives us a lot of resilience in many respects in terms of programs at different stages of their life cycle, but it gives us some complexity to manage in terms of managing cost and inventory and the volume benefits obviously are more widely portfolioed. I guess that's all a fact. It's not very interesting in terms of the message we're having with our supply chain and our teams internally. The fact is we have to deal with that, and we've got to drive cost, and we've got to drive the inventory performance on those programs. I guess the good news is the point that the portfolio over time is narrowing and becoming more focused on larger programs for the future. So the conversation we were having about the Trent 1000 and the Trent XWB, I mean, it's actually over 1,300 engines already contracted on the Trent the Trent XWB now. That gives us tremendous focus and leverage within the whole supply chain. It's a different kind of conversation when you're contracting for a program that's been that successful. So, you know, the business is evolving. You know, the portfolio is narrowing. We've still got a lot of resilience. It's still a broad portfolio in terms of the different market sectors that we're addressing. But the benefit of those new large programs is clearly going to help us. And that's directly linking into your question on the supply chain. That's the confidence, you know. From a route to market perspective, we can have a completely different conversation with our supply chain about a program like the Trent XWB for 350 than we've been having on some of the lower volume programs in the past. I mean, whilst the Trent 700 is a great success story on the A330, it's been going for a long time, and we weren't able to show our supply chain the visibility of just how long this program was going to run and how big it was going to be, because it's sort of evolved over time. It's a different set of dynamics on a program where you've got such a large order book, and the first aircraft hasn't even gone into service yet. So it's a big leverage point. So how are they responding? It's a tough conversation. The world's tough at the moment. But at the end of the day, if you want to be a partner on that program, then you've got to have the capacity, the capability, and the cost line to be able to support our ambitions. And it's certainly true that, you know, in parallel with reducing the supply chain, there are suppliers falling by the wayside. You know, we're ending up, we've got something like 70, 75, I think, suppliers now on the Trent XWB program. It's a much more focused portfolio. These are bigger, more capable suppliers that can drive cost. And actually, you know, have the scale to be able to access low-cost supply chains in Asia and other parts of the world, which needs to be a part of this answer.
David.
David Perry from J.P. Morgan. Tony, you talked about not doing 100 things 1% better, but about really doing things differently. You come in with fresh eyes, you've got this team of six people in. I mean, can you give us some real concrete examples of some of the things that are being considered that you are doing or may do that really will make that big structural difference?
Yeah. Well, firstly, it's about doing both. Sorry if I misrepresented that. We are going to do 100 things 1% better, and we are going to look at some of the structural changes as well. But the small address cost today team that we put together, we're really looking at the mechanisms that we use to support the broader workforce on driving that incremental change, making sure people are clear, equipped with the right tools, and enabled to actually go and put those changes in. And that's largely been about using processes like yellow belt training, you know, giving people basic project skills and an awareness of how they can go and work with their teams, and setting the environment in a different light as to just how high on the priority list an individual suggestion from an employee is going to be if it reduces cost. So it is about doing 100 things 1% better as well. On the structural side, there's a whole range of things that we've touched on, both, you know, across the defense and the civil aerospace businesses. We're really starting to challenge how do we organize and make our decisions around things that we do versus things that we purchase. It's a journey. There are various activities that we've outsourced. We've outsourced a lot of our logistics activity over the last few years. We have some of the proudest logistics people in the UK that were up in Derby, but not the most cost-effective way to do it in a Rolls-Royce structure, and not something, frankly, that we have the expertise in to keep up with the best in the world today. So we have outsourced that, and several of our employees have transferred to logistics providers over the last couple of years to do that. We're starting to look at our whole IT footprint. We're starting to look at our functional footprint in terms of how we support finance across the business, how we support HR across the business. and starting to become much more discerning in those areas. And I think, obviously, as those plans become public, all subject to consultation and subject to fairly detailed internal review, then we'll share with you the benefits that they bring. But no stone unturned, but a big focus on a lot of the functional areas in Dubai.
Just on the civil side, you mentioned the big opportunities going forward as well as big headwinds. I think the opportunity side is well documented. Can you give us some idea of where the big headwinds are on that side? And for you, Tom, I know it's early days on the sequestration side, but the kind of first look you've had, are you able to give us confidence that you will be able to hold the top line on your defense business
move for the US? Yeah, I mean, just on some of the headwinds, I mean, you know, you won't be surprised to know that people in Rolls-Royce and our supply chain are still looking to be paid more year on year, and trying to get the balance between the pay line and the productivity line in each of those conversations is clearly part of the challenge. We're working very closely with our trade unions across the world. And we're trying to make sure that, you know, when you look out in our external supply chain, that our suppliers are offsetting some of those natural inflationary pressures around pay. There's a big challenge actually bringing new programs to market. You know, there's always a maturing program to get the product quality and the leanness of the supply chain sorted out. And you know, achieving those on plan with the evolution of program rate is another area we spend a lot of time on. You know, there's a big headwind as we go through some of these new development programs to make sure that we're hitting those milestones and getting the maturity in line with our assumptions.
On sequestration, our favorite word, again, the point I would like to leave you with is the fact that with the breadth and depth of our portfolio and the number of customers we serve around the world, we feel like we're in a good place going into this environment. Frankly, and again, as I said, although we're not giving a market update in this meeting, as Mark said at the beginning, I don't think there's any defense leader who can look you in the eye and say they know where this thing is going to go. I've heard some in Washington, D.C. say this is the ultimate unguided missile at this point. It's just going everywhere. And so we feel good about where we are heading into this storm. We feel as if when we get the four C's right, we're going to be able to exploit opportunities that present itself. And you know, when it gets to the point where we're updating guidance, we'll see if we can muster up more specifics on where our top line and bottom line might be heading.
Celine.
Hi there,
Celine
from Arrow, Bank of America. I have one generic question probably for Tony and Tom. Mark, you can comment as well. Basically, how do you benchmark your businesses, so aerospace and defense? Is it only against your usual typical peers? So how do you think about that? Or if you're looking also at other industries? And also, I was curious to know if you're bringing in new people at middle management level from other companies, other industries that can help you change the culture. Because I know you're only a long time in Rolls-Royce, but
that's fine.
Okay.
But you preface that with you have a generic question, so yeah. Mark does all the generic questions.
I think in terms of benchmarking, I mean, we're a bit like a sort of Venn diagram circle. We sort of encroach on lots of other industries, and we look across the best of those in terms of where we see ourselves. I mean, clearly, I don't think it's any surprise that in terms of how we're measuring external performance, we're looking at against margin progression and return on sales. Clearly, CG at the moment is around the sort of 17-18% mark, and we're down the sort of 10-11% mark. And as we've sort of talked about in the past, I don't see any real structural impediments as to how we start to close that gap. It won't happen overnight, but it's sort of some of the things that Tony and Tom have been talking about this morning are the things that we're focused on in this part of the journey. You know, we've got a big order book. We know the top line's coming. You know, defense clearly is a little bit less certain than compared to some of our other sectors, but you know, when we talk about internally, there are things that are going to drive some of that behavior. You know, Tony talked about our portfolio narrowing. That's what I call variability. We have much more variability as we move forward. We'll have less variability. Volume is our friend. It drives drumbeat through the factories. It improves productivity. It allows us to leverage our supply chain. And if we just think from where we've come from, 20 years ago, the conversations we used to have with our supply chains about joining a Rolls-Royce, where, you know, we were clearly number three, and we had small volumes. Now we can guarantee bigger volumes. We've got suppliers fighting over themselves to come and join. All of those help to drive efficiencies. Of course, we talk about R&D. R&D is running relatively high in the cycle at the moment. A lot of MPI, new product introduction coming on. And again, I would expect, whilst you would hope that Rolls-Royce will continue to put money into R&D because that's what keeps us ahead and keeps us at the cutting edge of technology, again, volume will be our friend. So in absolute terms, I would expect it to increase, but as a percentage of sales, I would expect it slowly to start to decrease over time, not necessarily year on year, because it will depend on where we are in programs. And of course, finally, what I'll refer to as indirect costs, and I've spoken to a number of you on the usual investor roadshows that we do about that sort of area as well. We're looking at total costs, not just product costs, not just about low-cost country sourcing, not just about the suppliers, but actually how efficient are we internally, what we do versus what we make, and of course lots of opportunity to improve our indirect costs as well. So those are the sorts of things we're doing. The benchmark point I'm coming to really is really about return on sales for us in terms of where we're trying to get that next part. And then with respect to each other sort of metric that we can look at, we will look across various industry metrics and determine whether we think they are applicable to us or not, or where we need to be. And again, it's quite important on what we class as sort of, what does Rolls-Royce need to be world-class at? You know, what is our IP? You know, we can be world-class at finance, but you know what? It's not gonna move the dial. We need to be efficient and cost-effective and make sure we can do our stuff, but it's our engineering, our R&D, where we need to be world-class. That is what investors buy Rolls-Royce shares for. So it's making sure that we maintain those areas that really are cutting edge and that will distinguish from our competition. So that's, I would say, is the generic response in terms of sort of, you know, how we benchmark ourselves.
You know, Mark talked about the Venn diagram on defense. You know, not only do we normally look at GE and Pratt as benchmarks, but I look at our European collaborative partners, SNECMA, MTU, ITP. The people we work with, they're benchmarks for me because I want to be as competitive as them. And I also look at companies that many of you may not follow, like Williams is a little turbo machinery company in the United States that I want to compete with and beat in certain markets. And so I resonate with the Venn diagram with many intersections. You also asked a second question about people and talent. I think, again, I'm only here a year. I'm very impressed with the talent that Rolls-Royce has. But in defense, we're also on a charge to bring in some talent to help us in this environment. You know that old book that you read in business school, What Got You Here Won't Get You There, or something, it was about career management? It also applies to defense. The same thinking that made Rolls-Royce Defense successful over the last decades will not necessarily make us successful going forward. And so this is all about a cultural change that we're very excited about in Rolls-Royce Defense. And it will begin with people.
Okay, any other questions? Gentleman over there.
The only thing I was going to add to what they've said is really, and also, we don't underestimate, and neither do our customers, the benefit of benchmarking our customer performance against our competitors. We've spent more time really understanding delivery, quality, reliability, and responsiveness relative to our competitors over the last couple of years, I would argue, than we've ever spent. And that ultimately is the thing that pulls the top line in. And actually get that right, and the rest of the business below it works better as well, and the cost and the other, you know, financial metrics that pop out are better too. So a lot of time doing benchmarking on customer performance. Sorry, there's a question there.
Hi, it's Andy Chase from UBS. I think it's a good one for Mark. We've got some facilities in Singapore and Virginia in terms of where we are in the CapEx programs. Obviously, in the long term, these facilities are going to be good for margins, but in the very short term, in terms of where your loads are in these factories, are you seeing, is it going to be helpful for unit cost, let's say, at 12 months?
let me just try and give an answer. I mean, it's a regular question. Where are we in the CapEx cycle? I mean, people tend to focus on Seletar and Singapore and Crosspoint in the US are the ones that sort of they hear more about, and I guess there's more fanfare from Rolls-Royce in terms of the pictures and stuff you see. There's a lot of stuff going on in when you're increasing volume, and you have to be ahead of the curve. And it doesn't work where you can just smoothly increase stuff. It tends to come in blocks. We need to build new factories. We need to put expensive equipment in, the IT to support it. That in turn will drive the productivity because it's modern working practices, latest machinery. You ride the productivity curve with new equipment. So, I mean, clearly, as evidenced by the amount of CapEx we've got and our cash conversion, at the moment we're in a fairly heavy cycle. It is not where I would like it to be, but it reflects reality that when you've got a huge order book, you have to be ahead of the curve and ready to deliver on time to our customers. And of course, that's, you know, we want to make sure that we deliver on the promises we've made. So there is work to do. Of course, they will in turn breed improved productivity and lower unit cost. That is our intention. And of course, by having another facility within Seletar for assembly and test, similar to the one we have in Derby at the moment, that in itself is starting to breed some internal competition. And I'm sure Tony can talk far more eloquently than I can, having been in this part of the business. But the reality is, of course, the demand as to which way we will move things will be driven by where we see productivity and the benefits. And so that in turn creates some internal competition, which is good. And of course, we expect to see productivity and unit cost improvements coming through from the deployment of modern working practices and better facilities. But it creates a drag first and foremost in where you are because you have to get ahead of the curve before the volume arrives.
George Ferguson again, Bloomberg Industries. Question for you on the B-22, Tom. So the Marine Corps clearly loves this airplane. It looks like you're going to get a five-year, to the announcement is appropriate, a five-year purchase of that airplane. But the big challenge has been the operating costs, as you heard them talk about today. Could you elaborate a little further about where you think you could get these operating costs to per hour? And talk to us about it in the context of how do you make that airplane palatable to more of the world the more you get those operating costs down? What do you think the opportunity set is to do that?
Great, thank you. Yes. The V-22 is a product like the 787 whose challenges are well documented, right? So we won't go through that. But as you very well know, it's been deployed now very successfully over a number of years in the world's worst environments. As a result, there's a little bit of mythology that has built up about what the cost per flight hour is. Not to suggest that the data is wrong, just so few operators are ever going to put it in those kind of environments on a routine basis. So we're embarked on a two-phase attack here. First of all, the Marine Corps and SOCOM are the two main SOCOM, U.S. Special Operations Command, the U.S. Air Force. They are two different communities that we're trying to keep together to harmonize the synergies between them and the common fleet, but we're also working with Bell Boeing about whether or not it's time to recognize that maybe those fleets should go in different directions to satisfy different operational challenges they foresee in their futures. So that's the first thing we're going to do is make sure we're listening to our customer acutely enough to that if those customers want to go in different directions, we go there with them, okay? The second thing is the U.S. Marine Corps, very bullish, the Joint Program Office at Pax River, very bullish about the international uptake of this product. It's been in the press that Israel is looking to acquire V-22s. The U.S. JPO, I think, was in the press last week in a pre-Paris announcement about other countries that are actively looking at it. The fact is, many countries have been enamored with the technology. Most have also been put off by the acquisition and operation costs. So, to your question, the retrofit we're putting into the engine drives up the specific fuel consumption and down the time on wing problems. As a result, also drives down the cost per flight hour rather dramatically. The Marine Corps has some graphs that show it, and they take the legend off for public release, but it's a slope that would make anybody proud, okay? The international operators who are taking a look at this now see that they're at the point where they can acquire the airplane for an attractive price, especially with the multi-year that you refer to, and the ONS costs are now in a band that they see manageable, especially when they aggregate it for the operations they're likely to take in. So we're able to show the operator that the promised ONS cost for their environment is going to be what the ONS cost really is, not the operational data in the harshest environments.
Two more?
The very back there. Oh, Sandy, sorry. I've got my glasses off. Can't see that far. How could I forget your dulcet tones?
They're going to say, yeah. Yeah, well, 777X first. I think the facts of the matter are we put in an incredibly attractive proposal both technically and commercially. And that was fed back by Boeing in their assessments. We were ahead of their thresholds in terms of the fuel burn performance on the engine that we proposed for that platform. And we put in a very attractive commercial proposal with it. At the end of the day, we would have loved to have been on that program, but you can sort of stand back from the decision and say, well, we haven't lost anything, we haven't gained anything in some respects. The status quo has been maintained, and I guess, you know, stepping back from it, I can understand why a sort of Boeing-GE relationship and a continuation of the current sort of exclusive position they had, you know, that there'll have been other elements to that conversation that I can understand why that outcome happened. I don't believe it happened, and certainly Boeing publicly have been very clear that it didn't happen on the basis of us not being able to keep up with the technology race or make an attractive proposal. It was, you know, a decision that they took to maintain the status quo. So disappointed, yes. Unexpected, no, in some respects, I think, in terms of what's happened there. It's not the only game in town. Clearly, we have to perform on the Airbus portfolios that are going to compete with that aircraft. We still have a very close relationship with Boeing. I spent a lot of time with them yesterday and last night in terms of, you know, looking at next programs and the future programs that are going to come along. This industry has a habit of having no visibility on future wide-body or narrow-body aircraft programs, and then suddenly another aircraft comes along, and the whole investment cycle and the focus on that platform comes along too. There are a lot of other aircraft in that portfolio that at some point will require replacing, and this industry has an incredible reputation for suddenly from year to year and airshow to airshow coming up with that next program that looks to trump current technology. So we'll see where we get to. We're absolutely positioned. The technology programs are in place, and you know, the dynamic will continue on 777X. You know, we may or may not hear more about that program in terms of exactly what it is and where in the market it's going to be over the course of this show. Nothing changes in terms of our requirement to absolutely execute on those current programs and secure both the exclusive position we have on the Dash 1000 on the A350, but absolutely make sure that we continue to deliver on the A380 and the other A350 programs and the A330, which continues to be the drumbeat of our current relationship before those programs ramp up. Focus on the customer. That's the best protection we have in the near term.
Good. Well, I think we need to draw it to a close. It's, I think those of you who've got space on the bus, can I suggest you get on it quickly?
And, thank you very much.